Support for WGTD's morning show comes from the generosity of the family and friends of the late Frank and Beverly Falduto, two lifelong Kenosians who devoted much of their lives to the community in general and to WGTD in particular. Mr. Falduto played an essential role in creating WGTD nearly 40 years ago and later served as station manager and occasional morning show co-host. And we welcome you to the Friday morning show on WGTD HD, your gateway to public radio. I'm Gregory Berg. What an intriguing pleasure it has been for me to explore a brand new novel called Nine Island. And it is one of those cases in which it is a novel that on the surface centers on a character that has very little to do with me. And on the other hand, this character is drawn so vividly and is confronting such interesting, profound questions about life and love that you just can't help but be drawn into it. And of course, the more you read it, the more you realize that that she, even though she is an older single woman living in a luxury high-rise apartment building in Miami, maybe living a life very different from me or from you, in fact, is wrestling with many of the same haunting desires and wants, and wonders about the life she's lived and wonders what's stretching ahead for her. And that's a position many of us find ourselves in. And so I, on all kinds of different levels, I have really loved this novel called Nine Island. And it should be no surprise at all that it is so beautifully crafted, because it is written by a master novelist. Jane Allison is the author of a highly regarded memoir, as well as three novels, The Love Artist, The Marriage of the Sea, and Natives and Exotics. And she has translated many of the works of Ovid, and that is one of the intriguing threads woven into the fabric of this novel, which in some respects is autobiographical, and we will talk about that as well. And by the way, she's professor and director of creative writing at the University of Virginia. Again, this book, published by Catapult, is called Nine Island. And Jane Allison, we welcome you to the morning show.
Thank you. I'm very glad to be here.
I'm so happy to talk with you about this really, really intriguing novel. You yourself describe it as a nonfiction novel or autofiction or a semi-imagined memoir. So in other words, this is one of those intriguing books that sort of blurs the lines of standard genre. Can we talk about that first of all? And I'm wondering if it was a conscious choice for you to write a novel that defies easy categorization in this way. I mean, did you set out to write something that rides between the lines of easy categorization, or did it just sort of end up turning out that way?
I think I actually set out to do it. you're supposed to set out with something else in mind, but I have really been thinking a lot about those so-called genre differences. And as a teacher, I think about them, you know, even more because I'm confronting students all the time. But, you know, when you think about it, we have had these three classic distinctions or terms for, you know, centuries pretty much. And they're so arbitrary. We have fiction, which is defined by the content, so something that seems to be more or less made up. We have nonfiction, which is defined by what it isn't. And we have poetry, which is defined by the form it takes. So as three categories that are supposed to be mutually exclusive, they make no sense. So I'm kind of in the same camp as a bunch of other writers who are more and more interested in just turning it all back into something we might call literature, and letting poetic music fall into something that might be truth-based, that might be nevertheless very imagined. I studied classics growing up. That was my major. And so, you know, 2,000 years ago, there really weren't these sorts of distinctions. So a long poem could be about history, for instance, and you could find mythological content in images, so in visual images. So the distinctions to me seem, it's time to get rid of them is what I think. And so I really love writers like Sebald, and Rachel Cusk has been fighting against this, and a number of other writers are sort of pushing against these generic distinctions, and I guess I wanted to align myself with them.
Right. So let me then boil it down to a little more crass, much less nuanced kind of question, and just ask How much of this novel, in fact, springs directly out of who you are and the life that you have lived? And maybe I should also ask parenthetically, how important is it for us as the reader to even know the answer to that question?
I think actually the second part is a really interesting question because, you know, we have the idea that, that if you read something and you believe that it's true, you will have a greater investment. But I think that so far people who have read this haven't been able to figure out what's true and what isn't anyway, and I'm not sure what difference it's made. So that's already an interesting little question. But in terms of this, almost all the incidents are drawn from life. I did compress the incidents of two different summers into one. The place is real, and I did live in that building, and there's a mother, and she did do the things that she does, you know, a version of them as portrayed in the book. And there was an old cat in diapers and a duck that I found on the causeway. So probably 90% of the incidents are based on things that really did happen, and I was trying to find real connections between them. I mean, that to me is one of the thing I love most about writing. And when I wrote a memoir, I realized I was sort of shifting into that territory where, on the one hand, you are inventing things to create a sense of pattern and connection, but when you write a memoir, you're really looking back hard at your life and the way you think in order to find those same sorts of connections. And with this book, I was trying to meld the two. So sort of understand why certain things seem to me to be all gathering into this one book that were all based on truth, and then see what held them together and why they all could actually form something that had some kind of coherence and movement.
Right. At the heart of the main character in this novel is the fact that she has come to a point in her life after what she regards as 30 years of mostly disasters when it comes to trying to form relationships and romances with men. And she is trying to decide if it's time to just hang it up, to, in a sense, sort of just get out of that game, to kind of shut that door forever and stop wanting it and stop going after it. And to what extent does that reflect who you were and what you were feeling at this particular point in your life? And how vulnerable did you feel in a sense sharing that kind of sharing that aspect of yourself with the world?
Let's see. I think probably so this is, I'm now 54, and the character here is I don't actually say how old she is, but she's about 50. I think I did feel those things. I was trying to figure that out. It is true that after, and it was meant to be kind of comical, but also horribly real. She had a 20-year marriage and boyfriends before that, and then she'd gone on what I call a heat-seeking tour of old boyfriends to see if there was something she might have missed along the way she could go back to. And when one after the other is just a disaster, she just thinks, her mother actually says, maybe, darling, it's time to give up on all that. Maybe it's just time. And so she thinks, well, maybe it is time. And there could be a great pleasure in that. Like, well, wouldn't it be great to get rid of that problem and not worry about this anymore? And she is, meanwhile, and I was at the time, translating the Ovid's stories of sexual transformation. And so she's in Miami, which is this very sort of sexy, steamy place where youth is beauty and beauty is youth. And she's older and not altogether unattractive, but still not young. And so she's thinking a lot about bodies changing and women's bodies changing and where does desire fit on the spectrum of the older body. So she's thinking about that in a more intellectual way while working on the Ovid, but then meanwhile pondering within herself, well, and so maybe it is time and maybe it's actually fine. And why are we supposed to have a mate? And partly it's sort of, protesting too much because she just doesn't feel like going out to try and get one. But partly she really is trying to sort it out just mentally. Like, why, you know, what is wrong with being alone? Is there anything wrong with being alone if you can sort of make yourself happy in lots of ways? So, and I don't know if I felt, I think sometimes writers sort of give it up when they think about being vulnerable. I mean, you're writing, you want to be read, and you try and forget about being read while you're writing, and then afterwards you think, oh God, look what I've written. No, I'm going to have to deal with consequences.
We're speaking with best-selling author Jane Allison about her latest novel, which is called Nine Island. It might be just as well for us to take a moment and talk about Ovid. This is happens to be a name that I know relatively well because our local university a few years ago did a very, very intriguing production of his Metamorphoses. And in preparing, frankly, for that interview, I ended up kind of studying a little bit about Ovid. But I think otherwise he is somebody that I would not have really known beyond having just a, kind of the vaguest recognition of the name. And I think we have a lot of listeners right now listening to this conversation who maybe don't even know as much as I did about who Ovid was and his importance as a writer. Let's talk about who he was and also a little bit about the place that he has occupied in your life, both professionally and personally.
So Ovid, I first encountered Ovid when I was in, I went to a pretty low-grade high school, public high school in Washington that was sort of falling apart, but it did still have some great features, and one was a Latin teacher, and I signed up for a French class, but I got put in Latin. So I began to read Latin then, and then I went to college, and I thought, well, I kind of like this, so I'll keep reading it. But I encountered Ovid when I was 19 in college. I hadn't heard of him. I hadn't heard of anything. And he was a Roman poet writing just around the turn of the millennium, around about when Christ was born. And he was kind of the sort of bad boy of Rome. He was brilliant. He wrote this erotic poetry that was very intimate and often very funny, but got him in trouble. He wrote a book of transformations called The Metamorphoses. So that's a full-length epic, really, but it's poetic. And it has in it hundreds and hundreds of stories of change, and a lot of them involve, frankly, rape. I mean, there are famous stories people might know, like Daphne, who was being chased by Apollo, and to avoid being touched and changing and getting older and becoming a woman, she's able to turn into a tree. And there are many stories like that. Echo and Narcissus are in there, where Echo wants this boy so badly she becomes pure craving, and he wants no one to touch him. And so he wrote these stories that might or might not have gotten him banished from Rome. He was banished by the Emperor Augustus in, I think, 7 AD and had to go live the rest of his life on the edge of the Black Sea where he died alone. So he was a very, just a totally captivating figure because he was very sexy and extremely witty and very smart and to our eyes now psychologically so astute. And he had a long period in, say, the 50s and 60s when no one really treated him with that much respect. But then he's kind of come back because he's sort of postmodern and he's so clever and he's so psychologically smart. So I had read him when I was 19, and it was just one of those moments when I read something and my whole world exploded open. And I thought, oh, my God, he's telling these little tiny stories that are so kind of quick and mercurial, but they capture things that mean everything to me. I was trying to figure out, you know, I was in love with some boy who wanted nothing to do with me, and I thought, I am Echo, and he's Narcissus. I had these totally collegiate kind of appropriations of what I was reading, but I became obsessed with him, and I went on and did a variety of other things, didn't plan to be a writer, but then I found myself writing some 10 years later. And the first novel I published was about Ovid and trying to understand exactly what he had done that got him banished from Rome, which nobody knows. I mean, there are all kinds of, it's a mysterious question still whether he was involved in a scandal or he witnessed something or what, but he got himself in bad trouble and was expelled. So that was my first point of fascination with him, is just the content of his stories and then the tragedy, the perfect tragedy of his life. He writes about figures who, when they're transformed, they lose their ability to speak. I mean, there you are, a tree or a stone or a star, and of course you can't communicate anymore, so you're exiled from being human. And then he was exiled to a place where he did not know the language. So he's really just a kind of perfectly fascinating, tragic figure. And I've been working on him in not very scholarly ways ever since. I just think about him often, and I wanted to take the stories in his Metamorphoses that are mostly about young people encountering sexual matters for the first time and then suffering some kind of transformation, and retranslate them and try and get them out there so that young people might actually read these things, because so many of them haven't, and they're really great.
Right. Well, and as you have already sort of said, they resonate so powerfully into our modern day in a way that is, I would assume, very seldom the case with writings as ancient as that. I mean, there seems to be a remarkable sort of contemporary relevance to them beyond what sort of historical kind of interest they might have for us.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, you know, he even has stories about, say, a girl who is in love with another girl and she does not know what to do. And it's sort of, you know, and you can read it now and think, yes, this is something that so many young people are thinking about. Am I in the right body? Am I in the wrong body? I know what I desire, but I don't seem to be in the right body for it. And she is able to turn into a boy. So it's a sort of a kind of comic version on something very profound. But that's what his stories do. They put in sort of beautiful gem-like shape, very short shape also, things that can have so much greater potency even now, because he is really going to the core of, you know, how we feel inside our bodies and with our desires and our fears, and how we kind of navigate trying to ever have any contact with another human physically.
So explain how Ovid figures in the life, in a sense, in the daily existence of the main character in your novel, and to what extent that is a reflection of how Ovid has figured in your own life.
So she is working on translating his stories. That is something I had been doing at the same time. So really, I'm just working straight from what was real. But in my case, I was actually really carefully translating the Latin and trying to make it reasonably accurate. But she is transfiguring the stories, because that seems like, given that he's always writing about people being transfigured, it's fair game to do that to his own stories. So she is every day working on a little bit of Ovid and then turning it into a more modern story. And so in the text, I include some of, in the novel, I include some of those translations. And as she's doing it, she's sort of thinking through her own self with respect to what she is trying to sort out about desire and whether she wants to be done with it forever or whether she still just does plain feel it and what to do. So she begins with stories where mostly girls are trying to escape men. They are men, they're gods. And that's because that's her first instinct is, right, I'm done. I am done with desire. I'm done with love. I'm closing the door. That's it. What a relief. But then she begins to realize, no, I still seem to want something. And so then she turns to the stories where that is happening, where there are actually young women who are wanting. And she focuses on them. So she's kind of using Ovid as a way of portraying what's going on inside of her, even as she's looking around at Miami and seeing, you know, young girls running and a tree that looks really a whole lot like a young girl. And so she's filtering everything through the Ovid that she's working on as she's trying to solve her own problem. And she sort of speaks to him. I mean, he's the one, this is what, and I think anybody who has kind of worked on any long project that might involve solitude, you get really, they'll know that you get so sort of quietly and personally connected to it, that's the project in your mind. And so for a while, Ovid is just in her mind. And as she is kind of ruling out one old lover after another in her mind and any new prospects, she just keeps thinking, well, maybe Ovid is my long-term love. And, you know, is it so wrong to love what another mind made, meaning, you know, what he had made? I would say that's at her most sort of desperate.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Early in the book, there is this line as she is kind of pondering all of this, talking about Ovid. He's been my guide through the land of love from the start. So in a sense, Ovid, the writer Ovid, is someone who has, in a sense, helped her process what she has experienced, help her understand the choices that she's made, help her understand the way she is reacting to others in her life and so on. And we can kind of sense how a lot of us probably do that in the same way. I mean, maybe not with Ovid and maybe not with a writer, for instance, but probably most of us try to make our way through life with something that serves as some kind of a framework or point of context to help us make sense of it all.
Sure. And also another one she uses is rock and roll song lyrics. I mean, she's got Iggy Pop in her head and Marianne Faithfull and The Clash, and it's sort of all the same texture. It could be a line of Ovid from 2,000 years ago or a line on radio she's hearing right now in her head. Because those things, you know, these things sink into your mind and they kind of keep forming how you think, or they're sort of reflecting what you're thinking at the moment. And it can be all kinds of levels of culture if you want to go up or down the scale.
Mm-hmm. We're talking with Jane Allison about her novel Nine Island. There is something really poignant and intriguing about the place where the main character in your novel lives, and not just in Miami, but also in the building in which she lives, a building into which she moved with the highest sort of hopes. Towards the end of maybe the first chapter of the book, she's coming back finally after this sort of tour up and down I-95 where she's tried to reconnect with some of these old boyfriends. But one old boyfriend after another in flesh was not what he'd been in ether and not at all what he'd been before. So she comes back to Miami feeling, for the most part, disappointed. You write this, "Then 95 ended and I was back in Miami, where I'd moved 2 years ago, fresh from marriage and shaky, true, but full of hope and vim. Such vim. Live in paradise," all capital letters, the ad had said. "I'd looked up at all the glass shining high in the sky, enormous white clouds pulsing, energy in that upper air, ions spun through deepening blue, singing, 'Live the life.'"
You're a good reader.
Well, you're a good writer, and I think a lot of people, even if they haven't made exactly the move that were, in a sense, being depicted here, a lot of people have experienced that in their own lives, in a moment of maybe very painful transition, have set off for something that holds such promise. Tell us a little more about your experience of moving to Miami. What exactly drew you there? And if in retrospect you feel like you moved there in a sense kind of foolishly or with a little too much naivete, not really seeing the place for what it really was.
Well, I think it is true. Don't you think people have the feeling that the life they're living is not the life? There is another life out there, and we just have to, like, scrape things away, and you can go live that life, or maybe not, maybe.
I mean, I certainly think some people view life that way and themselves.
Yeah. In my own circumstances of moving to Miami, this is where I did a little conflating of time. In fact, this is where I did a lot of conflating. I actually moved to Miami from Germany in 2007, and I'd been in Germany for 10 years with my husband then, and wasn't happy in Germany and wanted to be somewhere else where I could actually speak the language better. And so I got a teaching job in Miami. So I was actually teaching at the University of Miami. So I moved there for completely non-foolish reasons, I would say. I needed a job and I got one. But it's true, I was also already then, and I've kind of squished together several years there. I was thinking, okay, this is the time now. I'm going to be independent. I'm going to be alone. I'm going to get my own place. I'm going to have a new job. I'm going to start all over, and I'm going to try and salvage what youth I might still have sticking to me, and yes, really, you know, now finally I will live the life. So I did have that as part of the mission, but otherwise it was honestly a job. So,
As you describe this character, she is coming to see this high-rise apartment building where she lives for what it really is, and in particular she is seeing it as being older than she ever realized. At one point, in fact, she says, thinks, "Have been here 2 years and only now see it's a cruise ship, empty old love boat, once all the pairs have walked the plank and gone on." That is the place where she lives. So much of it sometimes seems deserted. She scarcely sees anybody, and there's the sense that she is on an empty old love boat. And is that what it felt like for you?
That's what it felt like with the special hindsight you have when you're trying to craft a piece of writing. So I know at the time walking along those kind of musty old halls with crappy old carpeting and the brass sconces on the walls that were crooked, I know it did look like a cruise ship. In fact, I had a visitor over once, and she was German, actually, and she said, "Oh, this is a cruise ship," and that's why I got that idea from her. I thought, she's got it. That is exactly what it looks like, because it is on this very small island, and so you do see water pretty much from all the windows around, so you could imagine you're on a ship. But then it began to make sense when I began to narrativize the whole thing, to make it be like The Love Boat, that great old terrible TV show from the 70s. And I mean, she's thinking about the arc and about the pairs and the fact that she isn't one, and there's so much sort of weird pressure all around to be part of a pair in some form or other, and she just isn't, so she's feeling freakish. But I was kind of camping it up a bit with making the building like a love boat.
You are, the character is living in this high-rise apartment building with her very elderly cat, who by this point in its life has to be in diapers and needs all kind of attention and requires a great deal of money to be spent to keep the cat alive and well. And I assume that that is a reflection of a reality with which you were living as well. I'm curious, both for the character in this book and for you, what exactly that represented. I think it's something a lot of people can identify with pretty powerfully.
Well, I mean, it's true. That was based on my cat, Buster. That's his name. And he was at that point 18 and blind and deaf and in diapers and very sweet and having fits, seizures. So really, but as a woman that my character meets says, based on a woman I did know, she said, well, if he's still purring and eating, he's still viable, you know, so you have to keep him alive. And so when he was still purring and eating, I think it was, I mean, she's taking care of this cat. She's taking care of this old duck that she finds abandoned on the causeway with a wounded wing. Long distance, she's taking care of her mother, who is prone to falling, has this lack of labyrinthine function, it's called. And meanwhile, she's translating this dead poet, and she's thinking about all the old men in her life whom she called deadbeats, only because they're disappointing to her and they're sort of in the past. So I think it's just she's really dealing with dead and dying things in many ways, and wanting, you know, and she is still alive, and she does want something still to be alive, and yet here she is surrounded by just sort of age and agingness and dilapidation, and the building is probably sinking into the water because, you know, the sea levels are rising. So the cat was just one of the many emblems of this whole enterprise that she's involved in, sorting out where she is on the spectrum of desire and life and death.
Also in her life, as we've already touched on, are these past men. And she is, of course, trying to come to terms with her feelings for them, the legacy that sort of each of them has left. And they are all nicknames like Sir Gold or Mr. Body or Mournful Lawyer. I think one of them is nicknamed Devil. I'm wondering if this also is a reflection of something you did and what you think, what purpose was served in thinking of these past boyfriends or past male encounters as by these certain nicknames, and what it says about us when we choose to sort of think about people in those kind of terms.
Well, that's a really interesting question. I think that sometimes it's funny, you write a book and you're conscious a lot of the time, but often you're not conscious in exactly the areas that someone might ask you a question about. So I think the nicknames, it's true that these men are based roughly on a variety of men, and I've fused a few characters and so on, and certainly cartoons, some of them, because that's what the book is doing. But I think that in my mind, I often have nicknames for the people who are really haunting me, and often I think when women speak to each other, when I will talk on the phone with my sister or my girlfriend, we might just use a nickname for some of these men. Like call someone the North. I mean, just because she knows what that means, I know what that means. And in a way, it makes it more funny, I suppose, a little bit less earnest, a little bit more distant. So I think that's what I was doing with these men. Also, if I was going to be thinking about some actual men, I'm certainly not going to use any names. And to plug in a false name, I don't know, it's more earnest. If I called Sir Gold Scott or something, I don't know, it loses some of its magic. I mean, to call him something like Sir Gold shows how romanticized he is to her.
Absolutely.
You know, and he's a gold and the devil and exactly how diabolical he is. So they're exaggerations, but they reflect how she does, you know, see them now in this kind of super coloration of memory.
So in a sense, there are two really important things going on. One is that these nicknames are, in a sense, a heightening agent. And in a sense, like a focusing agent, it crystallizes them rather than taking them on with all the complexity of kind of a complicated human being with virtues and faults, sort of crystallizes them in something that one can sort of, in a sense, easily summarize and sort of a heightened version of whatever that is. And on the other hand, it's also a distancing agent that almost in a sense kind of turns it into a game that in a sense allows you to distance yourself from the pain that is also part of the experience of these relationships in the end, not following through to the end.
Yeah. No, you put that really well. Yeah, thank you. I'm gonna write that down.
I want to also ask you about the fact that this main character is forever counting. I mean, as she's walking about, she's counting. I'm not remembering the specifics very well, but maybe counting the lines in the sidewalk, or counting the number of lines she translated that day, or counting all kinds of different things. Ken, maybe you're getting sick of these kind of questions, but I'm curious if this was something that was part of you, and for both the character in the book and or for you, what purpose did that serve, or what do you think was going on with that perpetual need to count?
Well, first of all, yes, I have been a counter. It's a good old OCD trait, but as the character says, I know that counting is a symptom of something, but that is not going to stop me. I think that I didn't have to include that in the book. I think I wanted to, I wanted a kind of sense of relentlessness as she is pacing forward toward whatever her decision is going to be, and pacing forward toward, you know, I mean, obviously everyone is moving in one direction in life, and that's toward the end of it. But I was also thinking of when you translate, well, any kind of poetry, but there are beats, and the beats are described as feet, and so the idea of kind of counting the steps is part of the kind of mental atmosphere of doing any kind of translating. So you're sort of thinking about, you know, words moving forward and time moving forward, and how much time anything does take. So the counting is meant to be both a sort of like a low-level soundtrack to what's going on in her mind in a kind of obsessive way. But also it's just sort of funny now and then. I mean, there's one little chapter that's just counting and then it's over, just to kind of produce the different textures in a reader's mind that represent the kinds of textures that exist in the narrator's mind, just like song lyrics might appear. So these, you know, numbers might randomly appear. I think that's about it. I think that's the only good reason I have for the counting to be included in there. And also it's absurd. I mean, it's ridiculous to be counting. And so I hope that's sort of funny while being desperate.
Right, exactly. No, that's very much the way I reacted to it. I like that a lot. Do you have time for a couple more questions?
Sure.
Let me reintroduce you. My guest is Jane Allison, and we are talking about her very intriguing novel, which is called Nine Island. The main character in the book, who narrates the novel too, in a sense. I mean, we are hearing her thoughts as we read this novel. She is a woman around the age of 50. She has, for the last couple of years, lived in a fairly luxurious, if older, high-rise apartment building in Miami, but trying to sort of come to terms with all of the ways in which life has been perhaps disappointing, particularly when it comes to forging relationships and romances. And some of this character and what she experiences and feels springs out of the real-life experience of the novelist Jane Allison. We got to talking about texture, as you mentioned, the presence of the counting in the book. And this novel has an interesting texture to it, in that certain chapters, if we want to even call them that, are extremely brief. I mean, sometimes we will have a page which has two sentences, or maybe even just two phrases separated with a colon, or a very, very brief paragraph. Maybe it will be something that will be kind of bullet points, maybe three different terms, each given just kind of a stark definition, and then we turn the page and we're kind of back to the narrative. So just at a glance, this does not look like the standard novel. I'm curious if this was a preconceived design on your part, or if it just sort of emerged along the way. And either way, I'm really, really curious to know just how and why the book ultimately took this really kind of interesting, uncommon shape and appearance.
That's a good question, too. I think I was going to say, oh, it was preconceived, and then I thought for a second, and I thought, no, that's a lie. It was not preconceived, because I suddenly saw in my mind the earlier notes I had, which were just long, dreadfully long blocks of text. I think I wanted something airy at a certain point, and partly it's, I wouldn't call it cheating, but it's almost cheating, and that is that there is something about reading short things with space between them that creates its own energy. So a person wants to keep going. There's something kind of weird that makes you have more energy rather than when you're facing a big solid block of text or really long chapters, because you keep having hope, I think, that maybe something is going to happen in the next part, or, you know, maybe another connection will be made. So I was thinking about the physical, ultimately at some point in the writing, about the physical experience of the reader, like wanting to keep going and having this kind of breathlessness. And it's also, I mean, there have been a lot of books in the last few years that are working with fragments. I mean, one of my favorite books that came out quite a long time actually ago is Marguerite Duras, The Lover. And that's been one of my models forever. I teach it all the time. And that's in small blocks of text with space around them. And it's meant to sort of replicate the photo album. The book was originally meant to be a text to accompany. But then people like Jenny Ophiel had her wonderful book, Department of Speculation, which I know Jenny a bit, and I knew she was working on it, but I didn't actually get a chance to read it till I'd finished this, but I was happy to see a similar kind of form. And David Scheele's book called Reality Hunger, which is a manifesto about the state of fiction and nonfiction right now, is also written in little pieces like that. So a lot of people are working with it, and I didn't really want just little fragments. I did want discrete chapters, but I knew that they were going to be mostly short. And that would give me room to change direction a lot, so that you could have one paragraph on one thing, and then all of a sudden you turn the page and you're in a totally different zone of thought, instead of having to have the kind of creaky connections that you need to make when you are presenting something as a really continuous body of text.
I feel badly that we've talked about old boyfriends and your incontinent cat, and we have not taken any time yet to talk about another important figure in this book, namely your mother and the character's mother. And again, I'm assuming this is something that resonates out of your own real life experience. In this case, very much weighing on the mind of the central character is the fact that her mother is getting older and combating a serious kind of persistent dizziness that makes just kind of day-to-day existence a little bit more dangerous and makes the future more uncertain. So there is that concern, which a lot of people can identify with. I think one really intriguing point here is the way in which this mother living someplace else is interested in her daughter's life and asks her certain questions, offers her certain bits of advice. And on the one hand, she seems to understand her daughter. And in other ways, we really get this sense that she really doesn't, that she really doesn't begin to have a clue, maybe even, of just sort of the depths of some of the feelings that her daughter is wrestling with. Can you talk a moment about the way in which this character and the relationship between mother and daughter is crafted in this book, and what you want that relationship, in a sense, to represent?
Well, you are right, again, that this she's drawn very heavily on my own beloved mother. I think I was thinking, well, the mother, for one thing, as the character says early on, you know, that she is a lady who has sailed the seas of love, because she has had plenty of husbands and boyfriends, and the kind of men that aren't really boyfriends, they just are there one night and then they're gone. So she's had a pretty racy life, and so this is what the daughter has grown up seeing. So this is a model for her, which is not maybe been the most helpful model, but, you know, it's the one she has and the woman she loves. So the mother is meant, the mother just is in this because I think one thing the narrator's doing is she has a variety of female figures who are giving her advice and or listening to her, and they represent different ages in a way. And this was just based on reality, but I then realized it made some sense. So she has a friend named Kay who sends her these very kind of rapid texts telling her to go do things, and then a woman she befriends in the building named N, who is sort of halfway between her own age and her mother's and reminds her of, you know, she could be a cross between her mother and herself. And then there's her mother. So women at different stages in life, as she is pondering, you know, her own aging and where, you know, where she exists with respect to desire and aging. So the mother is at that really the end of the spectrum, and yet the mother is also, obviously someone that the narrator is going to be very much like one day, and she'll be in the same situation, and yet she does not have a daughter like herself to, help or not help. So she's there as a model, as another point of a sort of correction. You know, she'll say, "Darling, don't you think you should be thinking about this?" So she's in there to sort of alter the story a little bit, to make the narrator think about different things, even as the narrator is thinking very much about her mother in this one way, which is as someone she needs to care for and also someone that represents what she's going to be soon,
right,
or, you know, in 20 years, 25 years.
Exactly. One chapter opens with really these poignant lines. $5,000 a month is what she'll need, and selling her house will buy her only 5 years, even with Social Security. She's got more years in her than that. 10? Or maybe we should not sell her house. Maybe I should quit paradise and go rent her house and just become her now. And of course, that is a stark and forbidding sort of possibility that is very much on the mind of our central character.
And on the mind of many, 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 many women.
Right.
You know, most of us know that we are going to be our mother, and we're already an awful lot like her, and we can love that, and we can worry about that and mourn that, and it's a whole, all emotions can be connected to that thought, I think. Hmm.
I want to finish out by talking about kind of a term that comes up and a concept that is explored more than once. And at one point, it is described by the term porosity, P-O-R-O-S-I-T-Y, porosity. You say some have it more than others. The character of the quality of being porous. And, of course, we often think about that in terms like things like sponges and other objects. It's very interesting to think about the human heart and whether or not it is porous. One of my favorite portions of the book goes like this. Well, it's true. You started out knowing what you were made of and knowing you wanted to stay like that, stone. But then out of the blue one day, somebody split you. And where you'd been solid now was a space. The mechanics of this baffle me, even at this late date. In her heart opened an inconsolable pain, Ovid says. In another story, it's an unhealable wound. I wonder if you could describe for you what the way in which this was true. On the one hand, having this sense of being solid as stone, and then someone coming along and splitting you, and what that felt in the moment and what it felt years later, looking back on it.
Oh, boy. I think that goes back to the original Ovid meeting when I was 19. And early in the book, the narrator tells us, in fact, you know, I first met Sir Gold the same day I first read Ovid, Latin in the morning and painting at night. And so reading Ovid's story of, in this case, it was the story Echo and Narcissus, which is, like I said, about this woman who's just all want, and this boy, this man who just wants nothing. He's completely self-contained, and there's no getting around this problem. And my way of reading, and certainly my character's, you know, hyper-concentrated way of reading, this terrible passion she suddenly feels for this boy that I call Sir Gold, it just seems so well portrayed by Ovid. And so I was already kind of having the experience, which was painful. I mean, 19 years old, these things hurt so much. And then finding a way to translate it into something more beautiful by way of Ovid and that story, which helped. It really did help when you can turn it into something distant and beautiful and contained. But it does remain a kind of basic sort of biological question, like how is it possible that you can not know that you want someone or need someone, and then and you see someone, and then it's, I mean, I do believe, in my case, it was love at first sight, like this terrible event, and all of a sudden you miss this person who you really don't, you know, was never part of you. So how is it possible that your own kind of, you know, cellular containment doesn't last? And so this is one of the things she's wrestling with the whole way, even though that's the kind of, you know, originally juvenile way of looking at it. you know, why is it that you are born alone and contained, and, you know, how is it that you can go through life and not maintain that, and why can't you when to need something else that you can't have is so very painful, you know, emotionally. So I think I really did feel it, like, viscerally. It's like, I don't know how it can happen that you can be self-contained one minute and the next minute there's something missing and it's agonizing. So, and that story really did capture it perfectly, and it's the kind of thing that Ovid deals with a lot. It's just this sort of physical way of looking at the problem, you know, if something pierces something else, and then you're infected for life with love.
Right. Another place in the book where I think this is described in really remarkably vivid fashion, Lucretius and the atomists before him saw human senses like this. Tiny semblances of people and pine trees and oxen and so on were always flying from their source objects through the air. And if they struck your eyes or nose or ears, you saw, you smelled, you heard that thing. But to have your sensibilities deeply stirred, to be smitten with erotic love, only the rarest semblances could slip through the fine pores of your soul and smite you with that, infect you with desire. And then you go on to say, the opposite of erotic love, every pore you own squeezed shut. And, you know, in a sense, that almost suggests that it's either or. do you feel that for you? Like, I mean, either our pores are squeezed shut and we don't let anything in, or this other thing happens and we are pierced right through our souls and can do nothing about it.
I don't know how it works with other people, but for me, in terms of love or erotic love, that is exactly how it's been. There's either an instant sense, oh God, here is a real, this, yes, or nope. and no, nothing, no one can change from one to the other in my own experience. I'm hoping others aren't that categorical.
Right. And speaking of categorical, at one point, again, in talking about Ovid and his writing and what much of his writing seems to suggest is this notion of paenia and poros, echo narcissus, a woman who wants, a man who wants nothing. These two have stalked the world for thousands of years. And a little later in the chapter, you write, wanting is exactly what I've never wanted. And that is a conundrum if that's where one finds himself.
That's a paradox. That's right. And that's what she's trying to sort out, you know, between wanting, not wanting, wanting not to want, you know, wanting to not want. It's tough.
Well, it's an amazing journey that you take us on in this very, very intriguing novel called Nine Island. Again, it is published by Catapult, and the author, Jane Allison. Jane Allison, I hope you can tell how much I really enjoyed your novel, and I have certainly also enjoyed the great pleasure of speaking with you about it. Thank you so much, and very best wishes with all that stretches before you, including all your future writing.
Thank you very much. I've enjoyed this immensely. Best questions I've ever heard.
Next week, a full slate of interesting programs on The Morning Show, beginning on Monday with two different author interviews with books related to Pearl Harbor. One, an overview of Pearl Harbor, and the other, an examination of the 1942 Rose Bowl, the only Rose Bowl not to be played in Pasadena, California. Because of concerns about the war we had just entered in with Japan, the Rose Bowl was moved from Pasadena to Durham, North Carolina. And this interesting book tells the story of some of the young men who played in that game and later fought in World War II. On Tuesday, more War Talk, this time from Carthage professor Mark Miller, who has written a very interesting memoir based on the journal he kept while a soldier in Vietnam. It's called My Confessions from Vietnam. On Wednesday, Roseanne Mason and Faye Akindis from Parkside talking about the book Diversity in the College Classroom, Knowing Ourselves, Our Students, and Our Disciplines. It's a collective effort of 15 Parkside faculty, each with an essay on the topic. Thursday, Nan Calvert joins us with the new director of the Eco Justice Center. And on Friday, three interviews. One with a preview of this upcoming Kenosha Symphony season, one with the new head of piano at Carthage, Wael Farouk, who has a faculty recital coming up this next weekend,